Every day, neuroscience is adding to our understanding of the way we think, the way we know, the way we understand, empathize, and emote. Today's guest studies how the development of the human mind shapes our perception of the world. She's Dima Amso this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we sit down with storytellers, scholars, journalists, and scientists to make better sense of the stories that dominate public life in the United States today. Joining us this week is Dima Amso, a neuroscientist and associate professor in the Department of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences at Brown University. Dima, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you specialize in cognitive development, especially beginning at birth. So for the history major sitting in front of you, what is cognitive development? What are you actually studying?
Great. So what I study is how, you know, when infants are born, what we all see is that you've got this newborn, and this newborn doesn't really have a tremendous amount of knowledge, a tremendous amount of information, very little skill from the perspective of information gathering. So they are asleep 18 hours a day, very little ability to move their eyes, certainly can't control their heads, they're not crawling, they're not walking. Yet, by the end of that first postnatal year, everything has changed. You have an individual who's now capable of communication, of social interaction, of emotion, of language, of movement. So something amazing is happening in that first year and in the second year as well, as far as brain development and cognitive development. And in fact, it doesn't ever happen again in the lifetime that much information and that much change happens in the individual. And so what I try to do in my lab is I try to understand what exactly is changing. I study things like attention and memory, and how the environment shapes those processes and their development to get not just an average of what kids do, but also individual differences. What's the normative variability look like? So that's a little bit about what we try to do. We try to sort of understand how we become, how we go from being just sort of this small, tiny little nothing that doesn't do anything to something very much human, the human mind. How does it change and develop?
So how did you wind up in this space? How did you become a neuroscientist? What drew you to this?
Oh, that's a really good question. So in college, I was a psychology and an art history major, and I really could have gone either way. And I wanted to do a Fulbright in the Middle East is what I wanted to do, an art history Fulbright to look at how Western culture represents Eastern art versus how Eastern cultures represent Eastern art. And there's a sort of a long history of looking at these types of things in postmodern art history. And for one reason or another, it didn't work out for the Fulbright. And so I needed a job. And so I went to my psychology advisor and I said, I need a job. And she said, it's funny, someone just emailed me, this woman named Adele Diamond down the street in Waltham. I went to Tufts. And she's looking for a research assistant. And so I interviewed for the job and I got it. And then sort of the rest is history. I just sort of fell in love with the field. She herself studies developmental cognitive neuroscience, which is the developmental sort of cognitive development, thinking about how children think and grow, but at the same time adding the piece, which is neuroscience. A lot of people do one or the other. She sort of combines them, and I sort of fell in love with that idea in the 2 years that I spent in that lab. And then I went to graduate school.
So that first two-year period obviously is of monumental importance in terms of determining and shaping a person's personality and approach to the world. That development continues, perhaps not at quite the same pace, through later childhood into adolescence and then into like the 20s? When does that growth really stop?
So a lot of times people think of development as linear, And it's actually not. It's an upside-down U-shaped curve. It doesn't stop. It never stops. And so a lot of developmental process, you know, you see a rise, say, in the ability to control your behavior. You see that it rises from infancy through middle childhood into adolescence, into early adulthood. But then actually after a certain age, it starts to decline. So we don't see these things stop. We see them hit a peak, but we do see declines later in life. So really people talk about development and you think kids and that in adulthood it's a stable state, but really it's not. It never, what happens is not that it stops, it's that it starts to change from progression to somewhat to declines that you see later in adulthood and then later in life. So it's a lifespan approach.
So again, getting back to childhood and adolescence, obviously genetics play a significant role in how the brain develops and what the brain does in terms of controlling the body and emotions and all that. But the environment is a critical factor as well in shaping that person and who that person is and that person's mind. What are some, for lack of a better term, what are some of the ideal environmental conditions to bring a child to fruition, as it were?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for some time, people talked about nature versus nurture. And you know, we're sort of, as a field, as a scientific community, past that. Now we talk about nature and nurture. So as far as ideal environments go, there isn't one. If you think about it in the sort of close proximal sense, is there an ideal environment for your child that also applies to mine? Probably not. Because you're a different person, and I'm, you know, but as a species, what do we need as a species to have optimal outcomes? Well, we know a little bit about that. And as a species, what we need is one-on-one caregiving early on in postnatal life. We really are very heavily dependent on our caregivers. And we actually have not a particularly long, but a long caregiving period. And in fact, it keeps getting longer. Now people are staying home well into adolescence with their caregivers. And so the importance of the caregiver very early on is something that we're very certain. Supportive caregiving is important for learning about the world, but it's also important for establishing emotional and social development. Those are the things that, you know, the big picture items. As kids move into adolescence, something interesting happens. The family unit becomes the stable family unit as the most important source becomes replaced by peers. So peers become really important. And that might be because sometime in that particular period of puberty, we become capable of leaving the nest, so to speak, and of starting to think about starting our own families, etc. So we're sort of who the most important group is that differs depending on where you are in the developmental course. But in general, sort of that early supportive caregiving turns out to be one of the most important factors for resilience and for social and emotional development, but also for cognitive development.
See, so it seems to me that neuroscience in particular is changing the way we think about raising kids, and that there's a biological piece to this in addition to sort of that you know, whether or not you were raised proper, right? How are we just scraping the surface of that understanding of the role of the regions of the brain and when they develop and the role that they play in our personalities and our behaviors? Are we just how mature is our understanding of that?
Yeah, that's a really that's an important way to frame it. So when we do our science, we don't do it to most of the time we don't do it to inform how people should parent. And the reason for that, again, is that every single environment is slightly different. Every child, even twins, identical twins, are raised in slightly different environments. And those environments are very much shaping who they are. And so when we do our work, we do it because we want to understand process. We want to understand how the system unfolds. What are the variables that are acting on it? In doing that, we do offer critical insight into how massive variables, massive in the sense that they're things that are pervasive in different societies and cultures, variables like socioeconomic status and you know, class structure, things like that. How are they shaping children? Not for the better or not for the worse, but just how are they important in shaping outcomes? So if from that perspective, I think as a field, we have a lot to say about how, as societies, we should be thinking about child rearing. What are the important things, what are the important opportunities that as a society we should be offering all children? And this, I think, is an important policy discussion. And so from that perspective, there's a lot, the community has a lot to say. From the perspective of each individual home, I think it's more broad. It's that in each home, it means something slightly different to have a supportive, loving caregiver. And sometimes that's a dad, and sometimes that's a mom, and sometimes that's two dads. And you know, the community in general is sort of happy to point out the importance of the family, but the family could be a variety of different caregivers that are there to provide the kind of support that a young human needs. So
looking at the other side of this, there are certain environmental circumstances that can be detrimental to the development of the child and the child's brain and can actually have lifelong impact on health, and not just on the health of the brain. Stresses such as, and trauma such as violence, such as economic circumstances and so forth. Talk about that. What does that do to the young brain?
Yeah, so development is, like I said, so much is changing, and most of the time, everything that's changing with brain development and cognitive development is positive. In most kids' lives, right, they're getting positive opportunities for change, and that's what development is. It's opportunity for change. It's what we would call plasticity. It's a time of optimal shaping. So anytime you have opportunity for positive change, what that means is you have opportunity also for negative shaping. So if trauma and war and violence and exposure to maltreatment are part of the child's universe, especially very early on, because the system is being shaped so dramatically by any kind of experience, those experiences are just as shaping as the positive experiences that a child is going to have in their daily lives. And so when we talk about this, we talk about early life stress. So stressors that are experienced early in life have a particularly, they have particularly sort of risk outcomes, in part because they're happening at a time when the system is optimally plastic, as do positive experiences that happen early on. And so it's sort of two sides of the same coin. And so as a scientific community, many of us are trying to understand what these extreme stressors do to the developing brain, and not just what they do in the moment, but what they do 10 years down the road, what their outcomes are when that child is hitting puberty or later in adulthood. Because sometimes outcomes are not clear at the moment that the stressor is happening, mm-hmm. And they're sort of dormant until later.
So we need to take a quick break for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can hear this program four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square at the studios of Rhode Island PBS, where a wonderfully talented crew takes great care of us. I'm Jim Lutis, the Executive Director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Selva Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. My friend and co-host is G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal, who has also authored 17 books. You can find him on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is a brain scientist. Dima Amso is a neuroscientist and associate professor in the Department of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences at Brown University. She also runs Brown's Developmental Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory. So this brings us to a trip you took 2 years ago to a Syrian refugee camp. We'll talk about what you found there, but first tell us why you took that journey.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, so the Syrian war started many years ago now, too many to really want to even remember.
It's so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's sad.
And I am a Syrian woman, and I felt very frustrated as I watched it start from, you know, is this going to keep going? Is it going to keep going? And at some point you realize that this is now not just an emergency situation, but this is a prolonged crisis. And so many children are part of this crisis or part of this war. And many of them had been displaced, and many of them had experienced the trauma and the violence that comes along with a war of this proportion. And as a scientist, you know, you think, what can I offer? I'm frustrated that I can't really do anything about this. And it occurred to me that, well, actually, you know, I have this wealth of information in this amazing scientific community to lean on for how brain development is shaped, but not just how it's shaped by negative experiences, but what makes children resilient? What are the positive things that one can introduce into a difficult environment that might help buffer some of the effects? And so I was sort of intent on this. I was like, I am going to figure out, you know, where I can be of service. And so I started sort of talking to a group of colleagues at Brown, Bashara Dumani and Sarah Tobin in Middle East Studies, Carl Saab in Neuroscience, all of whom speak Arabic or Middle Eastern themselves. And we sort of thought, let's just go. Let's just go, put together this trip with an undergrad also, Tala Dumani, and let's just go find out where we can be useful. And Sarah Tobin at the time, she had done her anthropological work in the Middle East, so she knew people. And so she made a bunch of appointments for us, and we were able to sort of go into the camps and talk to families, but also talk to NGOs.
This was in Jordan or Lebanon?
This was in Jordan. And so we took this trip, and it was an opportunity to learn where we could be useful, where what our sort of knowledge, which is power, right, could serve a community of, and specifically what we learned on a sort of forecast, is that where we could be most useful is to offer these NGO communities that are working round the clock to offer the best services for children with respect to mental health and psychosocial support, where we could do their background research for them. Not research like working with kids and testing outcomes, but research like, you know, if you're working with an adolescent population, what do we know about the adolescent brain that could help you make your programming the most effective it can possibly be? So really just doing their scut work. And we've been perfectly happy to do that, actually, for whoever has come to us. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about that, too.
Well, that's quite an extraordinary thing you did, and you didn't have to do it. And you used the word service. Where did that public service element come from? Why do that?
Well,
you could have stayed here at Brown and written a letter to the editor.
Yeah.
You did something much more than that.
I appreciate you calling what we did extraordinary. I think, though, that that in truth, there isn't anyone who I would have said, hey, you have something to offer to this massive global issue. Are you willing to offer it? And that person would have said no. I think there's a desire to do something in pretty much everyone. It's just often not clear what anyone's unique talents can offer. And in this particular case, we didn't know what we could offer. And that was in part why the mission to go and figure out where we could actually be useful, which was great because we would go and people would say, oh, you're Brown. And, you know, we get a lot of universities coming. And we would say, well, we're not here to do research. We're here to ask you what we can do for you. And that's when people really were able to open up to us. Yeah, they're like, so you're not writing a paper on us. No.
You're here to help.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it was really... I think once you sort of get a handle on what you can do, and especially if it's something that you feel so privileged to have, which is sort of a, you know, knowledge in this community of scientists, then I think it becomes not a responsibility to offer, what you can do.
So one result of that was a two-day conference, Brains in Crisis, Stress and Resilience in Syrian Refugee Children. What did the conference look at? What did you learn?
Yeah, what we decided was a useful next step after this trip was to bring those world-class scientists that study stress and that study resilience and child development and put them in the same room with the NGO community that's working directly with the kids so that we could figure out, again, what is it that we can do, right? And so again, it's not about, I just want to go in and help you. I just want to go in and tell you what to do. No, I want to hear what you do and where I can be of service. And that's where sort of bringing the, you know, the scientists. I mean, we had the most world-class scientists in the entire world. And when I just sent them an email and I said, do you want to come and participate? And they're like, yes, I will come and participate. It was great. And so when we put these two communities together, it allowed them to communicate and it allowed us to continue to ask that question. What is it that this community of scholars can do to offer you the support that you need so that you can do your job to the best of your ability? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
So talk about resilience. I mean, not everyone from these terrible circumstances will grow up to have a terrible outcome.
Yeah.
So there's an element of resilience. What is that and where does that come from?
Yeah, so I actually didn't know that much about resilience. I had to do a lot of homework to learn about resilience. And, you know, there are multiple ways to think about resilience. There's the idea of orchids and dandelions, which is sort of a genetic story, gene by environment story. So a dandelion is a weed. And the idea is that there are individuals who, no matter what environment you put them in, they'll thrive. They have some protective factors. There are then the orchids, and the orchids need absolutely the perfect environment in order to sort of bloom and thrive. So you get the idea there that we come with some predisposition to be resilient, but that's going to interact with the environment that we're in. So there's that one way of thinking about things, and the scientific community is very cognizant of that. But then the other is a bunch of work that I learned about by a woman named Ann Mastin, actually, and others at the University of Minnesota. And I say Ann because it's her book that really helped me understand resilience best. And her and her colleagues' body of longitudinal studies of children who have experienced a lot of adversity shows that her book is called Ordinary Magic, which I love, because it suggests that resilience is not about some, you know, insane, you know, out of this world variable that is given to some people but not others, but it's the ordinary day-to-day experiences of children. Things like their ability to have perceived control over their environment, their ability to feel competent in what they can do, their social support network, things that are ordinary in our daily lives seem to be the variables that are defining long-term resilience in the face of adversity.
Reading is obviously an important part of childhood, and we're a storytelling show. We always like to talk about reading. Talk a little bit about We Love Reading, which is another program that you're involved in.
Yes. So when I was in Jordan, we met this woman named Rana Dajani, and she runs an NGO and a program called We Love Reading. The We Love Reading program is not specifically designed for refugees, although refugee communities participate. This is a program that's designed for any child that's not, you know, sort of in the transition from being a toddler into being sort of a middle childhood. And the idea behind the program, and this is an insight that she had, is that it, in particular in the Middle East, children don't tend to, culturally, it's not common practice to read for pleasure, that a lot of the reading that's done is more academic in nature. And she thought, well, I want to sort of see whether I can, you know, get this to catch. She calls it a butterfly effect. It's just this, she started this small movement where she just wanted to see whether children could engage in this process of reading for pleasure, something that her children had enjoyed while she was doing her PhD in Iowa, before returning to the Middle East to do her academic work at Hashemite University in Jordan. And so she thought, okay, well, what I want to do is I want to have these public readings. And a public reading is just a neighborhood mom or dad is interested in getting a group of neighborhood kids together, whether in their home or in a local mosque or wherever that person felt like a community, their particular community can get together and have the parent read just for pleasure and sort of gather the children. And that's how it started. And it started in a neighborhood in Jordan, and the program is now in 11 countries or more. The basic idea is that, you know, kids get hooked. And so We Love Reading is this been able to grow and grow. And now they put out, they publish their own books. And what children do is, yeah, and they have what's called a living library. So, a parent who you wanted to read to kids in your neighborhood, you'd get 25 books. And you would lend them out. So you would do your public readings, and children would take a book home, and then they would bring it back and listen to another story.
What a great idea, huh?
It empowers the community, which is why I think, why she believes it truly works. People in the community do it as convenient for their experiences, and they get really excited about it. And so I've been doing a little bit of work with Rana to look at the efficacy of We Love Reading on cognitive development in the past couple of years.
So we've got about a minute and a half left here, but I'm curious. You're a neuroscientist. You're looking at the development of the human brain. Kids today aren't just reading and playing outside. They're being put in front of screens at earlier and earlier ages, and they're playing on smartphones and tablets and in front of computer screens. Is that changing the human brain? Are we developing generations that are going to think and behave differently because of that early exposure to that kind of technology?
Screens are ubiquitous. Is it changing the brain? Everything changes the brain. Walking down the street changes the brain, right? That's how it works. That's how you go from being a newborn that's capable of very little to a two-year-old that's capable of so much, is that you get experiences that literally shape your brain. So I don't doubt for a moment that it's going to shape our system, but it isn't all bad, right? There's a lot of risk factors to daily digital experience, but there are a lot of positives to daily digital experience. So, there's cyberbullying, but then there's the idea of social engagement. And you sort of have to balance both of them. There's a child watching a ton of television, but then there's, okay, well, watch less television, and as a parent, I'll sit next to you and we'll engage in dialogue, which might mitigate some of the sort of attentional effects. So I think the reality is, screens are ubiquitous, and I think moderation in everything, and also keeping in mind that there's risks and there's positives in just about anything, including screens.
It's a fascinating conversation, Dima Amso. We need to leave it there. She's Dima Amso from Brown University. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne. I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.